mountain range, and off she goes, of course, with one or two of the dark girls, her nurses, and that has been her great help. But for years, 10, 15 years, she cherished a dream that seemed never possible of fulfillment. She cherished the dream that she could build a beautiful nurse's home and a home for little unwanted children, because there are many in that area. When parents die, nobody wants the children. There's only one choice for them, that is to die. And she's gathered these together, but the dream never seemed to eventuate because our funds are so slender and there was no money available. She's had them in a home, she's had them in little makeshift grass huts and all this kind of thing. Until one day on one of her treks, on the top of a 10,000 foot high mountain, she accidentally kicked a fossil, picked it up, and it was a beautiful shell. Oh, you know, 5 billion or 50 million years old. What's a few million? Doesn't matter very much. I'm not quite sure how old they were. I brought a number back with me when I visited her some time ago. And she got the natives to start collecting them also. She collected them each time she went in this direction and finished up with a very beautiful collection. And someone said to her, why don't you send one or two over to some of the top universities in Europe and see if they are valuable? And she did. And today she has a beautiful nurse's home and training center built on fossils at Telefomin. That's quite a story, isn't it? We're now facing new problems. We move from Telefomin right back again into the area where we are, the Bayer Valley, where we first commenced some 23 or 4 years ago. But the new problems now result from almost a second generation of native workers and churches, and the smell of self-government is in the air, and the intrusion of communist influences and outside influences like this are very strong. And the education that some has had has gone to their heads. There is no pride in all the world like intellectual pride. And this has gone to their heads, and many have become wealthy growing coffee. Every little church has its own coffee area and coffee plantation. We've introduced the coffee. They only had sweet potato. We've introduced all the other fruits possible that can grow in these tropical areas, pawpaws and mangoes and pineapples and peanuts and all these things. And so they become wealthy. One of our boys in our seminary at the moment doing a refresher course named Robin Thompson. Robin Thompson was up there. He'd just come down recently. And one day they said to Robin, the church at Kenan doesn't seem to be doing very well. It was the very first one I visited some years ago. I remember it so well. Church was full. People outside, listening in from outside as well as inside. Children everywhere. And somehow or other, old Mama, who was the pastor, he slackened off. And one by one, the people drifted away until there was hardly any signs of life left. And then he decided to divorce his wife and marry again, and finally the little church was practically empty. So they said to Robin, go and see what's happening up there. So he gets on his Honda motorbike. You can ride anywhere in New Guinea on a Honda motorbike. When the bike won't go any further, you pick it up on your shoulder and carry it. And then when you can ride it, you ride on a bit further. So off you go through the length and breadth of the land on these very rough tracks. And off he went. He arrived there that first Sunday morning and found one lone teacher haltingly reading the lesson, and a tiny group of exceedingly vocal, naked children, and one or two sleepy old folk and a few mangy dogs. So the next Sunday he decided he would go up a little bit earlier, earlier than this, and through the week, and round the people up. So the next Sunday there were a few more present, quite a few came. And he's one of these fellows who's never short of an idea. It said, you know, a missionary ought to be bendable, sendable, dependable and expendable. But he's not only gifted and dedicated, he also has the art of communication. And if you want a lesson in communication, here it is. To illustrate his sermon that Sunday morning, he secured a huge bunch of very much overripe bananas. And in the midst of his sermon, he broke one off, a very juicy, fat banana. And to illustrate what he was saying, he hurled it with all his force at the door. But sitting up in the back seat was an old man snoring happily away to himself. And the banana caught in Robin's finger, and you can guess where it went. With a great splash, it hit that old fellow fair and square. He jumped up with a yell and ran outside. That was the beginning of a great Holy Spirit revival. The blessing of the Lord came upon the place. But it came in this way. The next Sunday morning, they came from north, south, east, and west to see what would happen next. And that's how it worked out. And within a matter of weeks and months, new deacons were found and disciplined and taught. A pastor was found from another, from the Enger tribes back where Robin comes from. The Sunday schools restarted, the prayer meeting was begun over again, and the dry bones lived, and the soft banana made a hard core for a very fine church again there. May I take you over the seas now to Bangladesh, to East Pakistan, which now, of course, is Bangladesh, where one of the most frightful and terrible civil wars of history has just taken place. We are so complacent because these things do not touch us. They have touched us in Australia in a very intimate way and a very moving way, I can assure you. 12 months before this, you may remember that 1 million people died in the floods in this very area. At this time, more than 1 million died when the refugees streamed over the border. 14, 15, 16, 17 million. What's 1 million matter in these countries that are so thickly populated? In the civil war, at least another 1 million died. Who counts them? Nobody counts them, and nobody cares. One of our most successful mission fields was in the Garo Hills, and in this area of Mymensingh and Dhaka, and some of you may know these names. And the civil war was right in the very centre, or our mission fields were right in the centre where this took place, and right in the Garo Hills, across the border, was where the refugees streamed. I've moved and walked up and down this border a number of times. We had many thriving churches, hospitals, dispensaries, teacher training schools, Bible training schools, and the Garos with whom we worked were forced to flee. One of our students, a graduate, went to this area on graduation less than 3 years ago with his wife, Ian and Barbara. They little expected before they came home again on their first furlough, they would be plunged into all the horrors of the Civil War. I'm looking forward to meeting Ian on my return home in a few weeks. I haven't seen him since, but I've been in constant touch with him by letter. And for some reason which no one can quite explain or could foresee, when the Civil War broke out, all the senior missionaries were out of the area or on furlough. And Ian Hawley was left in complete charge. In one centre, 20 missionary personnel, and another 80 missionary personnel. And he had to make the decision while the armies of West Pakistan, this mission field, was in direct approach of these armies. The mission was right in the centre of all the carnage and the horror. How little we know what God has for us within a matter of a year, 2 years, 3 years. But God had his man for the hour in Ian. The first task was to pray, to comfort the bereaved, to hearten the missionaries, to dig shelters and to dig trenches and to be in them night after night and day after day, and then to stand and watch while scores of the menfolk were arrested and killed, and their womenfolk raped, and their possessions looted and their homes burnt, and the victims left on the edge of the river in great heaps for the vultures and the dogs to devour, or flung into the river as countless headless corpses floated down day by day, or filled the wells with dismembered corpses so that there was no fresh water left to drink. The missionary compound was 400 yards from the river edge. And he wrote to me and he said, how men can act with such unrelenting savagery and such utter contempt for the sacredness of human life is beyond all comprehension. Well, the answer simply is that that is war. And war is like that wherever it takes place. But there were two main centres, as I suggested, one at Pubna and one at Mymensingh, each with a number of missionary staff. And at the Joyram Kura Hospital was again one of our girls who had only recently graduated, a tall 6 foot lass, an expert basketball player. We always won the games when she played. But a girl who could do almost anything with great capacity and great ingenuity when faced with difficult circumstances. She was in charge of the hospital, the dispensary as a matter of fact. And they were right in the path of the invading army. Now, it was difficult to know whether to go or to stay, what to do, where to go. If they moved in this direction, they didn't know just from which direction the army was coming. It was very difficult. And, of course, they were much in prayer. And while they waited and prayed, suddenly, with overwhelming conviction upon the little group of missionaries there, came the word, as it were, from God You must go, and go immediately, and not waste a second. And everything was ready, of course. They were all packed up, just waiting to know what to do, and Ian was in touch with them. And they piled their goods on the jeep and moved out, and within 10 minutes, the army came in and smashed that beautiful hospital up until there was nothing left of it. The walls are still standing. It's being rehabilitated today. But all the beautiful X-ray equipment and so on we sent over was smashed beyond repair. But they escaped by 10 minutes. And I talked with Dale when she came home again, and I could tell you such a lot about her. Over at the other centre was my men seeing where Ian was, and with 80 missionary personnel, two of our girls with him, and the others were the native workers. And as they prayed, they had to make their voices heard above the whine of the attacking jets and the stuttering thunder of the machine guns and the cannon, not forgetting that a 1,000-pound bomb would drop here and there and everywhere just every little while. And their days and their nights were spent in the trenches and shelters, and they decided to go quickly, once, twice, five times, six times, and every time something seemed to hold them up. And Ian would say, no, we must not go. And finally, as they prayed through one long night, Ian said, I have a very strange conviction. We are not to go at all. And don't worry. This is the word in my heart to you. Don't worry. All will be well. We are to stay just where we are. And the fighting was drawing nearer and nearer, and the noise of battle as they waited through that night. But they quietly waited now, sure of God. And then someone said, it seems to be quieter. Then a big bomb went off, you know, just behind them somewhere. And another missionary said, do you think so? So they had a good laugh about that. But they listened more intently, and it did seem to be quieter after another while. And then, as the hours went by, they were quite sure it was so. And slowly the noise of battle died away. And the next day, they received the news that the West Pakistan Army had heard that the Indian Army was coming in from another direction. And they'd moved off, and one of the major battles that took place in that area took place at Dhaka, and so those missionaries were saved. There's one other aspect of this story which I would like to tell you. That is that Barbara, Ian's wife, was expecting a little one just before the situation closed in, which would have made it impossible for her to have expert medical attention, which she needed, because the Rh factor was involved in the birth of the little one. And by an exceedingly amazing chain of circumstances, transport was able to be made and the plane was there unexpectedly. And we know it so well. For I remember when she came home and the little baby came with all the attention she needed, I remember my wife making a little crochet coat for it and little baby things for it. Some of us are naive enough to believe that all these things that happened were of God and the direct leading and guidance of the Holy Spirit. I have not forgotten that God did not stay the onward march of events when 100 Christians, native Christians, were massacred one Sunday morning. I have not forgotten that God didn't stay the onward march of events when Jesus prayed in Gethsemane. That Jesus did not... preach in every sermon, and ever a sermon ends with they lived happily ever afterwards. It's not the gospel. For Paul it was stripes and imprisonment and stonings and shipwreck and a great weariness and finally his head on a block. But I'm remembering this, that we cannot trust God too much. Australia has become a land of unbelievable, almost inexhaustible mineral wealth, potentially. Iron and nickel and bauxite and uranium and copper and lead and zinc, silver, lead and aluminum. And somewhere there's a Lasseter's lost reef of gold, if somebody can find it. There are opals in two opal fields, and two men recently have become multimillionaires with modern machinery, digging up opals. We had no crude oil 10 years ago. This year, 65 to 70 million barrels. We had no natural gas 10 years ago. Now there's nearly 60 million thousand cubic feet every year. And new oil discoveries are being made. I read in a book recently about a man who found a treasure in a field and went and sold all that he had and bought it. It was told by the Prince of Storytellers, who said the kingdom of God is the supreme good, and who told us that where Christ is, where the Prince is, there is the King and the kingdom. We are asked to make sacrifices for him? No, that wouldn't be right. It's never a sacrifice. What fools we would be to talk of sacrifice when one of your own missionaries has said only recently, when we give what we cannot keep to gain what we can never lose. This man sacrificed a few shekels to gain a vast treasure. That was the message. Gladly and eagerly and almost with frantic haste. And if you read the story in the Greek, you'll find the verbs are in the present tense. Goes, sells, buys. Every earthly leader of men has finished his career in the grave, except one. And the champagne of victory is spilt in vain. And moths eat these blazes that we wear, and cups and trophies tarnish. And we will all soon be forgotten. He will never be forgotten. It is he we have chosen to serve, to share his cross, in the total commitment of our life to him. No animal ever built an altar, a chapel, a tabernacle, a cathedral. We've built an altar to him in our hearts. We are his bond slaves. We serve him on our knees. Our mind is his. Our heart is his. It is his throne. Our will is his. Our gifts are his, however slender they be. Our whole being is his. His forever. Only his, and our greatest task is to be like him. To this end, may the mark of the cross, its stigmata, be upon the youth of today with the tremendous opportunities they have. I close with these two very brief thoughts. I think they fit beautifully together. The first is T.S. Eliot, when he reminds us, you're not here to verify, to instruct yourself, to inform curiosity, to carry report. You are here to kneel. And the second is this. Our task when we kneel is to go forth, for out of our worship streams our service. And these strange hearts of ours were so made that their fullness comes in spending. When we serve, we rule. And when we give, we have. And when we die, we live. And when we lose sight of ourselves, we are most ourselves. And when we surrender, we are victorious. And the true man of God is not a torchbearer. He is the torch. For the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. And the next verse is so important, following Mark 10:45. Whoever wants to be great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever wants to hold first place among you, let him be everybody's slave.
Grant us ears, O God, to really hear. Grant us eyes to really see. And grant us a will to really obey. And now may grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from his Son, Jesus Christ, be and abide with each one of us, now and forevermore.